Just before we start today, are you a teacher? Most listeners aren't, because we aim this show at students. But if you are an educator of some form, I just wanted to let you know that I'm co-authoring a special series this month on effective studying with this week's podcast guest, Peps McRae, for his famous ultra-concise, ultra-high-value Evidence Snacks email newsletter. In the three-part series we've put together, I'm sharing some of my all-time favourite tips and tricks that I've learned over the years to help embed smarter study strategies in your school, helping students study smarter, not harder, going beyond the research recommendations to figure out exactly what we need to be telling students to help them put good ideas into practice. In the email series, I'm even giving away some of my teaching resources so you can pick up some ready-to-teach lessons so you can deliver these ideas directly into your school. So you get slides, a little video, and even a workbook for your learners. Follow the link in the episode description to catch up on any emails in the series that you might have missed so far, and then sign up to Peps's Evidence Snacks email list to get the rest of the series delivered directly to your inbox. For everyone else listening, all my non-teacher friends studying hard for their exams at school, university and more, I just wanted to say, especially if your exams are coming up soon over the next few weeks, hang in there, my friends, keep going, you've got this. And now, here's today's episode.
Welcome to the Exam Study Expert Podcast, helping you ace your exams at school and university through the psychology of high performance and the science of studying smarter, not harder. It's my pleasure to introduce your host, the Cambridge-trained memory psychologist and exam success coach, William Wadsworth!
Hello and welcome. Over the next few weeks on the podcast, we're going to be delving into the world of motivation, figuring out where our get-up-and-go comes from and how we can maximise our motivation to study. To kick off the series, I wanted to return and rebroadcast an episode from nearly 3 years ago with Dr. Erica Patel. She was and still is widely considered one of the leading scientists studying motivation in classrooms and other educational settings. And she's certainly one of the most passionate and was incredibly fun to talk to, as well as being very on point with the research she shares and the practical takeaways she provided for us as listeners. So I thought it would be great to revisit that episode to kick off this little series on motivation over the next few weeks. Because it was one of my earlier episodes, I'd yet got to get my recording ops down to quite the extent I have now, and you'll notice the occasional little bit of mic brushing on shirt noise, which I hope you'll forgive, because the substance of what Erica has to say is extremely good. I think you're really going to enjoy this episode. Without further ado, let's welcome Erica and dive right in.
My name's Erica Patel. I am an associate professor at the University of Southern California. I'm a professor of both education and psychology, and I've spent my career studying student motivation and even more specifically, some of the things that teachers and students can do to help support their motivation.
Just out of interest, what was it that first motivated you to get motivated about motivation? why pick that field?
Right, that's a good question. And there's lots of answers to that. I think part of it was, you know, as a student myself, I felt like I was always kind of struggling with my own motivation. Like I could find external reasons for doing stuff, but not always internal reasons that I knew were important, and yet I sometimes struggled to find. My father was a psychology professor, and motivation was a topic he constantly talked about and actually did some research on himself. So it kind of just struck a chord with me to pursue that area.
Picking up the family trade.
One of them, yeah.
I spotted that you teach a class at USC called Breaking the Code of College Success. I wish I could come and take that class because it sounds fascinating. I was just wondering if you had any particular sort of takeaways from that class that you'd like to share.
Sure. I love teaching that class, Breaking the Code of College Success, because it's really explicit in its intention to give just time and space to students to reflect on how to support their own learning and motivation. And maybe that of other students or other people they know as well. And then we learn some educational psychology research on the way, but only so that we can help ourselves. So what would I say are the key headlines? There's probably a lot of them, but I think I'd highlight two big ones. One is I am always routinely surprised to find that many of the students, of the college students I have in my classes, intuitively use some study strategies that really don't work that well for them. So a lot of my students have elaborate highlighting routines or believe that simply just rereading material is gonna just over and over again, is gonna help them learn. And every time I teach that class, I find that one of the big takeaways for the students is that they need to use study strategies that involve testing themselves and constantly asking themselves questions in order to learn. So that would be one big thing that seems like the students come away with a eureka moment, like, oh my God, if I want to actually learn, I have to ask myself questions all of the time. And then the second one is that I think that sometimes it's a revolution to students to recognize that they have a lot of agency in their role as a learner, and that if they can control their perceptions of things, they can actually control their whole experience and exert a lot of control over their outcomes as well. And we talk about that in a lot of different ways, mindset, interpretations of events, all kinds of things. I'm sure we're going to talk about that more later, but this idea that students have agency and are not just passive learners is a really important takeaway for a lot of students.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'd love to ask you a bit about your research a little later on in the podcast, but as a kind of bridge to getting into that, what I thought might be quite fun to do is just take some of the motivation strategies I see students talk about or use in anger. And I'd just love your slightly more informed opinion on whether that's a good thing for us to be doing or not. Perhaps the most kind of common advice I hear is to kind of set yourself goals when you're studying, so know what you're aiming for. What's your view on goal setting for motivation?
Definitely. Goals are helpful. They're critical. But there's always a but, provided they are well-defined, somewhat challenging, and you can actually achieve them. And they're not totally outlandish. Setting ridiculous goals that you can't achieve is probably going to demotivate you in the long run. And also setting too many goals that are competing with each other is potentially going to have problems for your motivation. But if you pair well-defined, challenging, achievable goals with plans for actually implementing them, you're definitely doing yourself a favor.
Cool. I sometimes hear about the distinction between people making distinction between sort of process goals versus outcome goals, where your process goal is, I'm going to work for 2 hours a day, and my outcome goal is, I'm going to get an A on the test. Any thoughts on the merits of that distinction?
You actually need both, I think. You need something that you value, some higher goal that you value that you're going to be working towards, and that keeps you engaged in the process goals. And without the process goals, you don't really have a plan for how you're going to get to that higher level goal that you actually value, right? So both are really critical.
That's smart. That makes sense. Rewards and punishments also, you know, incredibly popular and have all sorts of implementations. You know, I sometimes see, particularly once they're at college or university, students using some kind of incredibly elaborate strategies to reward themselves or punish themselves to keep them on track. You know, I don't know if you've heard of an app called BeeMinder, which basically makes you pay fines if you miss your process goals. Thoughts about rewards and punishments then?
Rewards and punishments definitely work to get people to do stuff. There's really very little doubt of that. That doesn't mean that people feel good about doing whatever they're rewarding and getting rewarded and punished for. But if you have some kind of undesirable task that you can't find another way to motivate yourself to do it, rewards and punishment are definitely going to get you to do it. Or most of the time, if you find good ones, if you find rewards and punishers that are actually meaningful to you, that is, they will get you to do that activity you may hate, right? I also think it's a pretty different psychological experience to be rewarding and punishing yourself. Presumably you're doing that because you value the goal, right? In the first place. Otherwise, why would you bother to exert those rewards and punishment on yourself? So that's different than when, for example, the environment, your teacher, your parent, whoever is exerting the rewards and punishers. That becomes pretty controlling and can sometimes backfire, though it gets people to do stuff. So I would just say it's effective, but hopefully it's a last resort or a technique people use when they can't find another way to find the internal motivation to do something.
Yeah. So that idea, it's possible to affect your beliefs for the worse about how interested you are in something by subjecting yourself to too strong a punishment or a reward. Sticking with that idea of beliefs, the next one I had on my list was growth mindset. And that's the importance of strategies like that in helping us overcome limiting beliefs, such as I'm not good enough, or I don't feel I'm good enough, or I'm talented enough to succeed.
So this actually relates to one of those key takeaways from my the class you mentioned earlier, Breaking the Code of College Success. So mindsets, efficacy beliefs, values, I would say those are all really critical sources of motivation and sources of people's success and students' success in their coursework and beyond. You said it well. If you don't have a mindset that emphasizes the importance of growth, that you're capable of learning, then your effort is going to suffer. And you're going to experience a self-fulfilling prophecy, essentially. Now, mindset is no panacea for performance challenges. Sometimes a task really is really hard and it takes a lot of learning and support to get it. But challenges are near impossible to overcome without a mindset of being able to do something or being able to learn or believing something is worth pursuing. If you don't have that mindset, then you're pretty unlikely to persist through challenges.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I suspect that maybe some of your, when we come to talk about your research, some of the kind of takeaways from that might perhaps speak a little bit to the sorts of things we can do to encourage, encourage constructive mindsets around some of these things. The final one I had was the biggest takeaway I had from my own intuitions when I was a student, particularly in my university days, which were that if I got one thing right, I almost didn't really need anything else in the motivational toolbox. And that one thing for me felt like it was getting into good habits, getting into a good routine. So I'd sort of wake up in the morning and I just knew what my schedule for the day was. I didn't have to make choices about it. It was just what I did by default, almost. What's your view of the roles of habits and routines in the mix?
Yeah, developing habits, at least the good ones, right? The good ones that emphasize behaviors that you're actually trying to develop, because you can also develop habits for things you wish you hadn't.
Right.
But developing habits are a great tool for learners. Habits are great because they get around some of the problems associated with pursuing goals. So we forget to start things, or we get easily distracted from doing things that are in pursuit of our goals. And habits actually make our behavior more automatic, kind of the way you described, so that we just do it, right, without much thought put into what we're doing. But I would add the caveat that reflection and flexibility are equally important when you are relying on habits. So specifically when our study routines seem not to be working, we have to be reflective enough to notice they're not working and flexible enough to make a change. So habits are great, but you've got to occasionally reflect and revise your habits. And that can be hard work.
Check in with yourself. Is this working? And if not, then do something to fix it. I'm just curious, was there anything you see your students doing to not help motivate themselves, particularly that you think that's just a really bad idea?
Yeah, that's a great question. And that's one is hard to answer because I often think students have some idea of what's good for them and then they just kind of don't do it. But I would say there's two myths I wish I could debunk, or maybe just two practices that I wish I could debunk. I can think of one really quickly for teachers, and that would be for teachers. I know you didn't really ask me, but for teachers, I wish I could debunk the myth that a controlling or a strict teacher is equivalent to a competent teacher. So right. That one quickly. And then, but for students, I think the practice or myth I wish I could debunk would be that social comparison is a good way to motivate oneself. I feel like students often rely a lot on social comparison to motivate themselves. And while that competition does motivate, I feel like there is a lot of psychological costs of using that strategy that maybe make it not worth it.
That is so interesting. That is so interesting. Because that was a huge, I'd never really thought about this until you just said it just now, but that was a huge part of what motivated me at high school. And I did really well and I was the best in my school as a result. But when I got to university, I was nowhere near that. I was, you know, easily in the bottom half. And to start with, I really struggled. And perhaps I wouldn't have struggled quite so much, both struggling academically and struggling as in being a bit unhappy. And right. Maybe that wouldn't have been the case quite so much had I not had that as such a big part of my motivation at high school.
Yeah, I think if we don't care for our own psychological well-being and feelings of confidence and security and self-worth as we pursue academic goals and any other goals for that matter, then we're going to struggle with many of our goals. So it's a careful balance students have to strike when they find the tools that get them to do the things they believe are valuable.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think it's such a good point. I'd love to come on and talk a little bit about your own research. I know we've perhaps touched on one or two ideas, but you know, I think I'd be right in sort of summarizing a lot of your kind of thinking in recent years as being around this idea of cultivating autonomy.
Absolutely.
What do we mean by autonomy, and why is that so important?
Yeah, so autonomy seems to be a really mysterious concept to many people, at least that word. I don't think the actual concept is mysterious, but the word is, and there's a lot of different definitions that float around in both scholarship and like popular understanding. But when I talk about cultivating students' autonomy, I'm talking about cultivating a sense that whatever the student is doing, they're doing it because they want to, because it is reflective of their sense of self, of their personal goals, or their personal values in some way. Another way you could say it is you experience a sense of autonomy when you fully endorse your own behavior and it feels as if it's reflective of yourself. I see autonomy as an experience that everyone wants to have. That is, I see autonomy as a psychological need that people need to experience in order to thrive. We both want to experience autonomy and we'll often do things so that we can have that experience of our behavior being self-reflective and endorsing everything we're doing. And then when we have that experience of feeling autonomous, it's a resource for us. It powers our engagement, our well-being, and our performance.
Some of your work has been so helpful because it's synthesized a lot of other people's work and kind of boiled it down and pulled out what the scientific community calls a meta-analysis, where you look across lots and lots of other people's work and kind of pull it all together and say, okay, This is what this body of work is telling us. So when it comes to autonomy, what are some of the messages that your meta-analyses have found out about autonomy?
I've done a lot of work on choosing, and that's undoubtedly a really important and effective strategy that teachers and parents, for that matter, can use to support their kids or their students' feelings of autonomy. But choice also has a lot of potential to backfire when it's not used properly. For example, when, you know, people can create choices that actually feel kind of controlling, where, you know, the student doesn't really like either option or doesn't really tap into their interests or their goals, or it's delivered in a kind of controlling way, or they don't feel when students don't feel ready to make choices, like they don't already have some pre-existing levels of, you know, competence or ability with the task that they're being asked to make choices about, then it can sometimes backfire. But on the whole, choice is an effective strategy. And that was pretty clearly that. That came out in meta-analyses I did. More recently, I'm not done with this meta-analysis. In fact, I'm revising it now because there's been a whole bunch of new work on autonomy supportive strategies in the classroom in the last 5 years. And so I've started updating a meta-analysis I created a long time ago. This meta-analysis that I'm now working on is intended to sort of decipher which practices that teachers use actually are most effective in supporting autonomy and other outcomes, engagement, performance, motivation. And what it comes down to, based on that meta-analysis, as well as a lot of the other work that I've reviewed over time and some of the work I've conducted myself, is that there's a lot of things that teachers can do, or parents for that matter, or friends actually for that matter, if you want to support your friend's autonomy, which is important to a good relationship. There's a lot of things that people can do, but whatever they do, it seems to all start with perspective taking. So to be an autonomy supportive teacher or parent or friend, you need to try to see things from the perspective of the student or your child or your friend. You need to be actively seeking out information from the student that helps you understand their perspective. It means being curious. It means being empathetic. And then once you actually have some understanding of the student's perspective, you use that information to help the student experience autonomy. So you might design course activities that are based on what you know about the students in your class and their backgrounds or interests, or you give students choices, like I mentioned earlier, choices of assignments so they can follow their personal interests or goals or preferred ways of working. It means you would give space in the class, not just to instruction of content, but a discussion about people's perspective about what's happening in the classroom, what you're studying and how. It means giving space for people to express their emotions and being empathetic to those emotions, and really listening and collaborating with students to make decisions about activities and assignments. It's a pretty long list. It means explaining the reasons for the choices as the instructor that you are making about the course or the assignments that tap students' perspectives, not just from the teacher's perspective, but you want to explain your why of what you're doing in the class from the student's perspective. Overall, it means being open, flexible, and collaborating with students. And when you respect students in that way, they feel autonomous and they thrive.
Yes, that's so interesting. I wanted to ask a little bit about, you know, whether there's anything that students can do to help themselves. So is there anything else perhaps I can do as an individual in a classroom?
Absolutely. Yeah, I often lament that, like I think I said this earlier, I'm just going to repeat myself in this podcast. That's fine though. I lament that many students can be somewhat passive in the classroom. But when students actually recognize that they have agency over their own motivation and to some extent over the classroom environment, that is, they can change their own motivation and the support they receive in the classroom, this can change their whole experience. Plus, provided students assert their agency in a collaborative rather than confrontational way with their instructors, they can also improve the teacher's experience in the classroom and their teacher's efficacy. So it's kind of a win-win. When students are agentic, they are both likely to feel more motivated and likely to benefit their teachers with their agency. So I would challenge students to recognize when they're being passive and unengaged in their coursework. And this is the exact time to assert their agency and try to change their experience. So I would tell them, ask yourself whether it might help you to request that your instructor do something different or explain why something is important or provide choices or something else, and then actually make those requests.
Seeing learning as a two-way street, not just you're sitting there to be spoon-fed at.
Yeah.
More recent work suggests there may be a glint of truth in the phrase pride comes before a fall. When you're proud of something, that can be associated with maybe working less hard the following day. Tell us a little bit about that piece of research.
I like that research too. That was work I did with one of my amazing graduate students, Injun Seo. And we found by collecting some daily data from college students for a few weeks that when students experience positive emotions and pride in particular, that led to coasting the next day. That led to working less hard to pursue their goals the next day. So basically, feeling positive keeps you working on the task in the moment. You like it, so you keep doing it. And that's great because positive emotions can help you build resources and skills on the spot that help you later on and in the moment. But positive emotions are also a cue that you can move on to pursuing some other goal, right? You're feeling good, so you must be doing good on that goal. So let's free up some resources for another goal that needs attention. You might think this means kind of conversely, negative emotions would lead us to investing more the next day, but that's actually only kind of true. It really depends on if we have a lot of self-control or not and the exact type of negative emotion we're experiencing while we're working on some goal. For example, feeling shame one day leads us actually to decrease our investment the next day rather than increase it if we're lacking in self-control. But yeah, a little bit counterintuitive that when you feel good the next day, you might work less hard.
Yeah, that's so interesting. That's so interesting. Erica, what are the big questions you're working on now?
Great question. So I'm really obsessed with this idea that students recognizing their agency and developing a mindset that acknowledges that their motivation is malleable and the classroom environment and the support they get is malleable and responsive to their, agentic behavior, their attempts to assert themselves. I want to find a way to help students as that idea so that they more readily leave behind that tendency to be passive in the classroom and assert their agency. So I've been working lately on interventions that can help students adopt that mindset and also think about the behaviors, not just think, but practice the behaviors in the classroom that are about asserting their agency and trying to discover how effective an intervention like that would be. So that's my latest work. We've been testing that with college students now, and we want to see if we can develop a version of an intervention like that for high school students as well.
Really interesting. Any kind of clues about what those interventions might look like? What sort of things are you looking at?
Yeah, they look very similar to the mindset interventions that you mentioned early on in this podcast. So the mindset interventions typically communicate with articles that include research and professional opinions and testimonies from other students who have tried adopting the belief and seeing how it works for them, just the effectiveness of adopting this perspective that motivation is, in my case, motivation is malleable and the classroom environment is malleable. So we do that. We present evidence to students demonstrating that having that belief can be helpful, and being agentic actually does change people's motivation and experience in the classroom and their teacher's behavior, because it really does. And give them testimonies. And most importantly, probably the way our intervention is differing from mindset interventions is that we're also trying to give them very specific behaviors to practice in the classroom and asking them to generate their own ideas for ways they could be agentic in the classroom so that they can improve their own motivation. We've also toyed around the ideas of like daily, or not necessarily daily, but regular reminders for students in text messages, or creating an app that would help remind people of behaviors they could use to be agentic in their classroom. So in a nutshell, that's what it seems like it looks like right now. We've tried it out with college students 3 times, and it seems like we're able to shift people's mindsets along agency, and that when they do adopt this more agentic mindset and orientation, their engagement in class increases and their interest in class increases. So promising.
Really interesting. Really interesting. Can I just ask one tiny footnote question, just to bring it to life? What sort of things go into those text messages? What sort of bits of advice do you give about mindset and being your own agent in the classroom?
Right. First of all, we haven't tried the text messages yet with college students. It occurred to us when we were working with high school students or starting to work with high school students that they needed smaller chunks of information and more regular reminders. So we're not sure, you know, if the text messages and reminders actually help, but we anticipate they do. Right. But what they would include is, you know, one, just reminders of what they learned. Like, hey, do you remember that we mentioned that when you ask a question in class or ask your teacher to explain why you're working on this particular activity, or from their perspective, why this is useful or important, that will actually change how interested you feel in class and, you know, how supportive your teacher is of your motivation in class. So first, we just remind them of things they already learned, but also we give them very specific practices like, hey, today, try when you get bored asking your teacher one of those exact things. Explain why the particular activity is how it's used in the real world, or how you might personally use it in your daily life to try to find why this is valuable today. And other behaviors that we, you know, for specific things we just throw out for them to try that day.
That's so interesting. And so interesting to sort of hear some of this, the absolute specifics as well. Erica, I always finish with what I sometimes call our time machine question. So if you were able to go back in time and bump into yourself, perhaps back in your high school days, and give that young teenage Erica a bit of advice about the future based on what you've learned since then. You mentioned that you were struggling with motivation, for example, back then. What would be the advice you might want to give?
I would give myself the same advice I am giving other students right now. So I would tell myself to leave behind that tendency to be a passive learner. I'm not now, but I was then when I was a teenager, and invest in shaping my learning opportunities to actually suit my needs.
Amen to that. Erica, where can people perhaps learn a little bit more about your work if they're interested, and certainly follow what you're up to?
Yeah, you can find out what I'm up to and what my students are up to at motivationlab.wordpress.com.
Well, thanks again, Erica, for such a fantastic conversation. I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did and are feeling awash with some fresh motivational strategies to help you stay consistent in your studies. Thanks so much for listening today. It's been great to have your company as always, and I just want to wish you every success in your studies.
If you've got exams coming up, you can now get all of William's favourite tips and tricks to save you time and get you higher grades, all in one handy cheat sheet. Grab your copy at examstudyexpert.com/free tips. Thanks again for listening, and see you soon.